Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website, click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner. It will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that particular chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships and to turn any negative emotional state I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click on the link, download it, print it off, copy it and use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. If you do that, you can get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have called in with comments, questions. They've either called in and actually been stepped through the worksheet process, or they've talked about and we've discussed with them various aspects of these tools and how they can be as simple and yet as powerful as they are. Listening to those over and over again is a wonderful way to create a tutorial for yourself so that even if you're not able to be here live in the show and call in and get support, you can become expert at using these tools. And if you've got any questions, comments, problems you'd like our help in applying these tools to, give us a call at 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I can announce you by your area code. And we're grateful to everyone who chooses to do that because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. Our intention with this work and this Internet show is to be of service. So here we are on the 11th day of the year. This is our second day of doing some work with The Way of Mastery. The Way of Mastery, again, is a book that was written between 94 and 97. Some people would say it was channeled during that time. And it was channeled by John Mark Hammer, who now goes by the name JM. And yesterday we read a little bit of the editor's notes, and then we read the first two pages. So today, I'm just going to read a little bit more and go back to the last paragraph we read, the last couple paragraphs. You are, as a soul, you are the individual divine spark. And as you begin to choose to withdraw the attention and value you have placed upon material things, as you learn to simplify the nature of your own consciousness, as you realize that you can surrender into something that seems beyond you, and that you can entertain the insane thought of trusting the invisible, as you do that, you come more and more to be less and less. And as you become less and less of what you thought you were, conversely, you become more and more of what your Creator created you to be. What is that? That is the thought of perfect love in form. That is being a channel, a simple vehicle through which the love, the creative energy of spirit can shine forth. Your only task becomes the cleaning of your windows, the polishing of your floors, the weeding of your garden, so to speak, so that that light of creation can pour forth unimpeded. No longer will you find the need to defend perceptions you had identified with in error. You will indeed know when you have come to that state of awakening. For you will be able to look upon all created things that you have ever experienced, all the reactions you've ever held within your mind, all the perceptions, all the judgments, all the desires that you have ever held for anyone and anything. And as they arise in your mind, they will not disturb your peace. You will stay at peace. And you will smile. You will see that within your consciousness has arisen all saintliness and all devilishness. You have been both the saint and the sinner. And your happiness and your unhappiness have been merely an effect of where you chose to place your attention. To break into the reading here, this is what Dr. Michael Rice calls one of the greatest travesties of our culture that we've had hidden from ourselves, the fact that we are creators. And this is how we create. Whatever we choose to focus our conscious awareness upon, we create our experience of life from. And the book just said, and your unhappiness and your happiness have been merely an effect of where you chose to place your attention. That's been happening for every one of us every moment of our entire lives. We have been taught to believe our happiness and our unhappiness are caused by the people and things outside of us either complying with our wishes or not. The book goes on to say, indeed, beloved friends, I come forth to meet you wherever you are because I have chosen to use the infinite power of consciousness that was given to me by the Creator. As equally as it was given unto you, I chose to use it to discover how deep delight can be when the mind is focused only on seeing from and seeing only the mind of Christ. So I'm going to come forth and meet you wherever you are because I have chosen, this is Yeshua speaking, to use the infinite power of consciousness, by the way, the same power of consciousness that the Creator gave to you, I've chosen to use it to discover how deep delight can be when the mind is focused only on seeing from and seeing only one thing, the mind of Christ. I have therefore called to myself all multitude of experiences, even when I walked upon your earth as a man, to challenge myself, to test myself, to condition myself to rise above, to transcend all possible experiences that could distract me from the remembrance of who I am. Who are you? You are the extension of love in form. You are the extension of the creative energy in form. You and all of your brothers and sisters share that experience, share that origin. The book goes on to say, by the way, my crucifixion was simply the climax of my own direct choice to be challenged by the events of space and time so that I could cultivate within myself the ability to see from and to see only the perfect mind of Christ. The point I'm trying to make with you is that in each and every moment, what you are experiencing in the realm of your emotions and mind and the effects, to a latter degree within the body, these are there because you, from your infinite freedom, have simply selected that experience to focus your attention on so that you can see what the effects are. And this is true whether we're conscious of it or not. This effect machine, this creative energy flow that originates in our minds and our brains is always functional, even when we aren't aware that that's what's happening. The book goes on to say, the insanity does not come from having chosen to see something other than the mind of Christ. The insanity that you experience as your pain, your suffering, your seeking, and your dramas, this comes only from your mistaken choice to become identified with what arises in the field of your awareness. You therefore lose sight of innocence, for all events are perfectly neutral, and you are free to see them any way you want. When a child is born, and many of you who are mothers know this, you can experience a depth of joy that is unspeakable. Likewise, you can also experience fear and contraction at the thought of having to be responsible for a child. When a loved one dies and you experience grief and suffering, rest assured it is because you have chosen to contract your attention. Then all you can see is the loss of an animated body and thereby convince yourself that you have become separated from the loved one. I speak from experience that separation is an illusion. When death occurs in your plane, in that very moment, you still have the power to choose to recognize that something has changed and to shift your attention to a different faculty that the body could never possibly contain. That faculty is one in which you perceive and hear and communicate with that spark of divine light, the soul, that seems to have given up the idea of trying to keep a physical form animated. This is imperative. In fact, it is the very first step of the way of the heart, the first step in awakening, is to allow the mind to access, to observe, to breathe into this axiom of truth. Nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. You experience only the effects of your own choice. Going back to what Michael Rice says, this greatest of all travesties is that we have been convinced that we are not creators. This is how we create. We choose the focus of our conscious awareness in each new present moment, and that is what creates our experience of life in that moment. The book goes on to say, during the first part of this course, we will be building lesson by lesson on what I am choosing to call the way of the heart. It is the way unknown to the world. It is a way unknown to many that would call themselves spiritual teachers. For it is not a way of resting on or becoming dependent on magical means. It is rather that pathway which cultivates within you the decision to turn your attention upon your own mind, upon your own behavior, upon what is true and real for you moment to moment. As you do that, choose to study it, to consider it, to feel it, to breathe the light of spirit through it, and to constantly retrain the mind so that your mind assumes complete responsibility in each moment. Why is this necessary? Because without it, there can be no peace. Without it, you cannot transcend the false identifications that you have chosen. You need to come to the point where you say to yourself, I have done this to myself. I did it. I must correct it. No one is to blame. The world is innocent. In the lessons that follow, we will be communicating with you more and more deeply the finer points of the way of the heart. For it is that way that was taught to me. It is that way that brings about the reversal of every thought you've ever had about anyone or anything. It is that way alone which allows you to pass back through the eye of the needle and to come to rest in perfect peace, that perfect peace from which you have sprung forth. The way of the heart is not the way of the intellect. For indeed, that aspect of the mind, the intellect, was never designed to be your master. It was designed to be a humble and, if you will pardon the expression, a very stupid servant of the awakened heart. Now, to break into this again and talk about a quote that has often been attributed to Einstein, who said, we were given a precious gift, the intuitive mind, and we were given a faithful servant, the conscious logical mind, the rational mind. We have some great difficulties going on in our world right now because we live in a culture which has forgotten the precious gift, the intuitive mind, the connection to Holy Spirit, as they would say here. And to go one step further and really confound this, our culture has elevated the conscious logical mind, the egoic mind, the rational mind, to the level of master. That mind that here in the Way of Mastery says was designed to be a very simple servant of the awakened heart. The awakened heart in this work might be another word for what Einstein called the intuitive mind. The book goes on to say, the heart is that which feels all things, embraces all things, trusts all things, and allows all things. The heart is that in which the soul rests eternally. The heart is that which is beyond space and time, and it is that spark of light in the mind of God. It's that spark of light which was called Christ. Only in that will you find the peace that you seek. you will discover that the pathway of awakening is not a pathway of avoidance. Rather, it is a pathway of truthfulness. It is not a pathway of accomplishment and pride, but it is a pathway of releasing from the consciousness every hope and every wish to be special, to see yourself as having made progress, to release yourself from that, because when you want to be special, when you want to see that you've made progress, you want to be able to pound your fist upon your chest and spread your tail feathers and prance around. But this way is a transcendence of the hope for something and somehow getting God's attention so that he will look upon you and say, oh, you've been such a good person. Yes, come here. We'll allow you into the kingdom now. This way of the heart is a way in which you will come to cultivate, regardless of your inner experience or degree of awakening, you will cultivate the willingness and the art of returning to the simplicity of empty-headedness, of not knowingness, and you'll do that with each and every breath. This is a way of life in which all things and all events become an aspect of your meditation and your prayer until there is established once again within you the truth that is true always. Here's a statement of one of the many ways that the Way of Mastery says, this is the truth that is true always. Here's a quote. Not my will, but thine be done. For of myself I do nothing, but the Father does all things through me. Close quote. This is difficult for the Western mind. This is a crippler for most people when they first get it, the Western mind. The book goes on to say, imagine then a state of being in which you walk through this world seemingly appearing like everyone else, and yet you are open and spacious within. You are empty within. In truth, you desire nothing, though you allow desire to move through you. And you recognize that desire as the voice of the Creator guiding your personality, your emotions, and even your body to the places, events, people, and experiences through which the tapestry of the atonement, the at-one-ment, is woven, through which all the children of creation are called home again. In that state, you trust the complete flow of that, whether you're asked to give a speech in front of 10,000 people, or you're asked to tell a friend the truth of your feelings, or whether or not you are asked to sweep the streets and live penniless. For in truth, mind, that trusts the source of its creation, that mind allows all things, trusts all things, embraces all things, and transcends all things. Rest assured, whenever you feel frustration and anxiety, it is because you have decided not to trust the truth. And the truth is simply this, quote, only the Creator's plan for salvation can work for you, end quote. Your way must always fail. For your way begins with the illusory and insane assumption that you are a separate being from the mind of God, and you must therefore direct your own course. For if you are sick and diseased and not at peace, why would you decide to know that you know how to create peace? This requires great humility to accept the first step of the path. Here's the first step. Quote, I have done all this. I must undo it. But I have no idea how I did this. Therefore, I must surrender to something else. I give you this thought, and I would ask that you consider it well. What if the very life you are living and each and every experience that is coming to you now since the moment that you decided, I've got to awaken here, what if every one of those experiences was being directly sent to you of your Creator, because your Creator knows what is necessary to unravel within your consciousness to allow you to awaken? What if the very things you're resisting are the very stepping stones to your homecoming? What if you achieved a maturity along this pathway in which you were finally willing to let things be just as they are? If it was necessary to sweep the streets, you simply took a breath and said, Father, you know the way home. And then you began sweeping. And up into the mind comes the thought, oh my God, I won't be recognized. I won't stand out. People won't think I'm special if I'm just a street sweeper. And then you recognize, oh, aha, no wonder my Father wants me to do this. I've got to flush this up so that I can look at it. This disidentified notion, I need to disidentify from it and learn to be the presence of love in the sweeping of the street. In truth, I tell you that the least among you, according to your perception, is already equal to the greatest. And there is none among you who is less than the Creator, than is less than the Christ mind, that is less than I am. The way of the heart begins by accepting the humility that you have created quite a mess within your consciousness. You've created a labyrinth and gotten lost within it, and you do not know the way back. It begins by accepting that of yourself, you can do nothing. For all you have managed to achieve is the creation of a whole lot of insane dramas that are occurring nowhere except within the field of your mind. They are like chimeras, like dreams. In truth, there is no difference between a waking state in which you would be the director of your life and the dreams you have when the body sleeps at night. They're both the same. I wish to direct you to peace, even that peace which forever transcends the understanding and comprehension of the world. I desire, because my Father desires it through me, to bring you wholly to where I am, that you might discover there is someone that got there ahead of you, and that you can look closely and you will say, ah, that someone is myself, and I've always been there, but I forgot. In the end of all journeying, in the end of all purification, and indeed purification is still necessary, in the end of it all you will discover that to awaken means to have journeyed nowhere. It means to have arrived at a goal that has never changed. Awakening is only a remembrance. But it is a remembrance not just of the intellect. It is not an idea as you would understand ideas. It is an idea that vibrates through the whole field of your beingness, so that even the selves of the body, yet while the body still remains, coalesce together in its present form, even the selves of the body awaken and relax into the truth that is true always. So that's three more pages of The Way of Mastery, and I will invite comments or questions. Our caller number is 563-999-3581 for anybody who wants to be following along. We ended at the top of page 8. We'll start there again when we pick up. 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1. Susan, are you there?
I'm here. Dr. Tim, hearing this now has been just life-changing just to hear this. And I don't know how anybody else who's listening would feel, but I remember you telling us that you spend, that JM himself and whoever was recording with him were given these readings a month apart, and they were invited to spend a full month on whatever amount came through the first time to go through these, meditate upon them. And you talk about the darshans where things are fleshed out and fleshed out and fleshed out. And I'm already getting the feeling that I want to go back and read everything again and go over it carefully again and not go too fast. I'm not really asking you to do that. I'm just wondering if anybody else who's listening has that feeling, or if you have that feeling, and if we didn't go ahead, how would we, just read again and things every time you read it? This time, I mean, I've been through this book. This is so absolutely delicious today. It's like the answer to my monster, for instance. Where was it that he said in there, you have the dark stuff and you have the light stuff? It's all there. You just put your attention at one place or another. That's it. I've known that before, but not the way he said it. I realized my monster is perfectly okay. I mean, I just don't have to beat myself up about a monster that's there, because we are all created the same. We're all created alike. And we're just focusing on different aspects, which leads me to a question, but I won't ask it right now. Anyway.
Well, and what we focus on creates our experience of life, creates our experience in life and of life.
Yeah. A denial of the presence of the darkness to do that. And
it's
so
just
my
acknowledging
question
that
is,
the darkness is self-created, that the darkness is an interpretation of all that is, and all that is just light. That's all there is the light of creation extending.
Didn't he say, though, somewhere in there that we all have the darkness, and we can choose to look at it or not? We can choose to look at the light instead. Did he say it was all our creation? Maybe he did, and I missed that. So I'm thinking,
here's the first axiom, right? And he says several times in the three pages I just read, it's just all events are neutral. He says that line, right? All events are neutral.
Yeah.
And he says, whatever way that you choose to try and do things must fail, because that's your conscious logical mind trying to do it. We reached the first axiom, which is nothing that you experience is caused by anything outside of you. No devil, no demon, no person outside of you acting the way you don't want, no tornado, no... What you experience is a creation of where you focus your attention. And this way of the heart is not the way of the intellect, right? It's the heart is that which feels all things, embraces all things, trusts all things, and allows all things. The heart is this energy of creation. And he says at other places in this book, love feels all things, embraces all things, trusts all things, allows all things, and therefore transcends all things. So then it's talking about how you will develop, you will cultivate, regardless of your inner experience or degree of awakening, you will cultivate the willingness and the art of simply returning to the empty-headedness and the not-knowingness with each and every breath. Well,
so
Byron Katie talks about that state of just not knowing, right? This divine ignorance. You trust the complete flow, whether you're asked to give a speech in front of 10,000 people or you're asked to tell a friend your feelings. the truth of your feelings or whether you're asked to sweep the streets and live penniless. Rest assured, wherever you feel frustration and anxiety, it's because you've decided not to trust the truth. And the truth is simply this. Only God's plan for salvation can work for you. Only the creative flow itself can turn out the way it's supposed to. I give you this thought. What if you would consider this, well, what if the very life you're living, each and every experience that is coming to you since the moment that you decided, quote, I've got to awaken here, close quotes. What if everything that's happened after you decide I want to awaken is being directly sent to you from the Creator to allow you to awaken? Because what if creation itself is the only thing that understands what's necessary to unravel your consciousness and allow you to awaken? What if the very things you're resisting, the very stepping stones, are not roadblocks, they're stepping stones to your homecoming? What if you achieved maturity along this pathway in which you were finally willing to let things be just as they are?
That's so huge.
I was trying to skim through this to figure out if I could find where there was some writing that translated the way you were thinking about it, that we're bringing the darkness on ourselves or whatever.
Mm. There was something in the reading today that you did that I either misheard or heard and misunderstood. The implication was that we have the full spectrum. And we have it. I don't know whether we gave it to ourselves, we invented it, or it was the way we were made.
So here's a part. Why is it necessary to do this? Because without this, there can be no peace. Right? This way of the heart is a pathway that cultivates within you the decision to turn your attention upon your own mind, upon your own behavior, upon what is true and real for you moment to moment, and then to study it, to consider it, to feel it, to breathe in the light of spirit through it, and to constantly retrain your mind so that it assumes complete responsibility in each moment. Why is it necessary to claim complete responsibility in each moment? Because without it, there can be no peace. Without it, you cannot transcend the false identifications that you have chosen. You need to come to the point where you say to yourself, quote, I have done this to myself. I did it. I must correct it. No one is to blame. The world is innocent. Is that the part you were referring to?
I don't even know, because I don't even know if I would recognize it if it were read again, because my mind did something. But this is all helpful. I guess the most helpful part is that bottom line is we made it. We are creators, and we're creators of both what we interpret as darkness and light. But we created those.
And you're creating your experience of the flow of life, which is completely neutral.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why this feels so needed right now to hear these words, and I imagine other people will feel the same. Maybe it's because things are changing outside of us, appear to change. We perceive change. I'm afraid I'm going to put my foot in it by saying it is happening to us. But the whole situation outside, you were saying that you have many clients who are talking about anxiety and so forth. We are creating our anxiety. We are creating this weird response to a situation. Even calling it weird is an interpretation. I realize. But it's an odd time to be alive, and it's nice to be alive. But hearing these words is very, it's just delicious, because there are so many, many of us butting heads with opinions and all kinds of things that don't need to be that disturbing. It's like coming back to a resting place.
Well, let's see. Someone else has a hand up here. Area code 541. Is this Cecilia? Celinda?
This is
Celinda.
Yes, it is. Thank you, Michael. I'm looking at Michael Rice on my phone. Thank you, Dr. Tim. Susan, I heard what you heard also, and I think it was an elaboration that you, Dr. Tim, was saying to a reference, and I wasn't going along with the book at that time, so I don't know what part it was, about the devil. And the way I heard it was the devil, both the devil and the angel is within it, us. And like I'd heard from a therapist once a long time ago that, you know, in order to get to the angel inside of us, we have to go through the axe murderer first. And that made an impression on me. But there was a concrete experience I'd like to share with you and Susan that happened to me. Because what you're reading here, although I'd already read it previously, really jumped out at me today. And that was the thing about once that we have decided that we have to awaken here, every situation in our life, every situation is not an accident. It is a combination of external events and our interpretation upon them. And I have a very long-term dear friend who was a deacon in the Episcopal Church and is now a priest, and she's part of one of my spiritual travelers that I depend with, that we travel along the path with each other. And one time when I first met her, and by happenstance, and saw her running or walking along the street in Reedsport over 30-some years ago, and decided I need to run or walk, whatever the situation is, with that lady. And she one time shared with me on one of our walks that she had this horrible dream of a Satan coming out of her belly. And I had already come to the conclusion at that time that Satan was in me and God was in me. And I was still kind of dualistic at that time, but at least I had taken Satan from out there and realized that I was somehow involved with this creation or this illusion or this personage that was quote-unquote called Satan. And I said, aha, so you have finally come to recognize that Satan is inside of you, not out there, that we have been projecting all along out there. And so I want to share that with you, Susan, because it's helped me. And all along, I still hadn't taken Jesus, Yeshua, off the cross at that time in relation to being my sacrificial lamb. However, that was the beginning of my journey. And so I share that with both of you because it is a process. It is definitely a process of little ahas and big ahas and everything coming together to this magnificent purification process that each one of us is doing, going through, which is so gentle. It's like being a cashmere sweater bathed in woolite. It's as gentle and or as severe as we want to make it to be. So the interpretation, thank you, Dr. Tim, was wonderful, your interpretation of what Susan is struggling with.
So, Celinda, you that was exactly what I was thought I heard, and I haven't got the book in front of me at the moment either. So I'll go back and try to find that and mess around with it myself.
Yeah, and I don't know what passage Dr. Tim was talking about, Susan, but what I realized when I didn't find it immediately was, oh, because Dr. Tim elaborates a little bit, and I really appreciate that, Dr. Tim. It's very helpful. I'm taking little notes that I put beside the actual words in the text to help trigger me, because they're very meaningful, so thank you very much. Yeah, I think it was one of Dr. Tim's expansion of what the Way of Mastery was saying in that actual text, and so really appreciate that. Yeah, but you did hear it, so all of the above.
Yeah.
It wasn't in the text. And Dr. Tim, I heard him say it. I have no idea if he did say it, but that's what I heard. And
well,
I really appreciate you saying that.
That's the place to be at when you're reading something like this or listening to somebody read this. The place to be is just what Celinda just said. I heard it. I have no idea if the other person said it or if it's actually in the book. But that's what my mind showed me. And especially when we have some form of upset, tension, or negative emotion with that hearing, that's when we should understand, oh, this is a misinterpretation. This is a distortion. This is something from my past getting triggered. This is like in the bottom line observations, that says if I have a negative thought about myself or somebody else or a negative emotion active in my mind, at any point in time, I can instantly know three things. Number one, the first thing is this is a lie or based in a falsehood. Number two, this is an old tape playing in my brain. This is not about the present moment. Number three, if I take an action from this interpretation, from this set of pictures my mind is showing me, or from this negative emotion, I'm just going to make my situation worse. I can't possibly make it better by taking an action from that negative energy or from the distorted perception that my mind is showing me when my energy is negative.
Well, I heard something very positive, and that is all of us, for whatever reason, we did it ourselves or whatever, all of us have the full spectrum. For me, that was like being forgiven. If we all have it, then we not only we have a choice, which was added on, and we don't have to focus on that, but since we all have it, one of us isn't worse than the next person. And I tend to go to, oh my God, I'm never going to finish my work. I have this evil in me that I can't seem to clean out. I'm still mad at the same person for doing the same thing. And it's been 20 years and I've done 20 worksheets and I'm never going to get over it. And all this negative stuff. But you kind of neutralized it by saying, this is a common experience and we don't have to focus on it. That's a big relief.
That's just shame, Susan.
Well, I don't know what it is, but it's nice not to have to look at it.
That's for me, that's shame. And that's exactly what I've come to. It's shame. Shame is not embarrassment. Shame is not being unworthy or undeserving of something. Shame is something is inherently wrong with me. I am bad. I am evil. I am a horrible little person, and I deserve to be punished.
Well, that's an early
and that's
thing
what
for
I'm
many
dealing,
of us.
That's what I'm dealing with right now. That's why I chuckle. That's why I love this. I don't want to dominate the conversation, but Susan, you are my Siamese twin. Only you took the anger route and I took the fawning route.
Oh, that's very interesting, and it may be true. Yeah.
And how sweet it is that we found each other, and Dr. Tim helped us connect to each other, and Michael. How sweet it is. And how sweet you are, Dr. Tim. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Well, you're entirely welcome and deserving, as we like to say.
So, Dr. Tim, what do you think?
Yes.
Might it be good to just start at the beginning again tomorrow and do those, do what we spend 2 days doing what we, as if you could even probably run the tapes and take a nap or something and not go any further for the moment, just to do what JM's team did? What do you think of that, Celinda?
Oh, Dr. Tim, I was just going to ask you, may I offer my input on that for Susan and you?
Sure.
I think my personal feeling is that you will run the show, and rightfully so, as you see fit. Here is my input, Susan. What I have realized from being a born-again evangelical Christian and reading the Bible over and over and over as a Christian is that what I'm learning is Spirit is telling me, go within, Celinda. Go within. Stop referencing to outer interpretations of what that means or outer expansions. I fight that, Susan. I fight that, Dr. Tim. I want to go, in spite of my resistance to what my husband says, I want to go to the outer authority and find out what it says. And what Spirit is telling me, go in, go in, go in. And so my preference would be, Dr. Tim, for you to go ahead and continue reading the volume itself. And I will go in, and with your very kind elaborations that you do, your little inserts that you do, which are super helpful for me, I need what I have the choice to do. I'm looking at need as possibly a word I can eliminate here. What I have the choice to do is go in. And if there is something that I'm being led to further expand my awareness, Spirit will tell me or will drop it right in my lap. I will see it. It'll be on a free shelf somewhere. There'll be a reference. Something will help me. I'm taking it step by step by step. And maybe that way I will stop having spiritual indigestion by trying to get the whole enchilada right now. In other words, trusting process and trusting my purification is in Spirit's hands with my cooperation. It's not something I do. It's something I am in relation with Spirit with, and in that process, the Spirit does it with my participation.
Well, it sounds like you were listening, because it sounds like just a reformulation of what we were just reading in this lesson. So what will happen?
I don't know.
But here's the idea. The idea is that I will take it very slowly. And we might start tomorrow back at the beginning, depending upon what I moved on, or we might make it through the first lesson in a few days, and then for the rest of this month, just review that first lesson, which would be similar to what the original participants were able to do. They had the tape, and they could listen to it as often as they liked throughout the month, and then in the next month, they got another tape. And they could listen to that as much as they wanted, or they could go back and listen to the first one. And there are some exercises and suggestions that are made from time to time in the process of reading the book. And it's good for whoever chooses to do that to make time to do those exercises. And sometimes when people do that, they reach a different level of stuckness or a different level of enlightenment. So we'll let it unfold, and I appreciate the input. I'm glad that you're finding it useful that I'm making some comments along the way. And And we'll leave it at that for now. We'll go slowly, and we'll invite anybody who wants to go even slower to make that comment, to call in, raise a hand, and ask specific questions, or to just generally ask to slow down, because that will make this far more blended, participatory, and I think effective experience for everybody who wants to stick it out.
I love that, Dr. Tim, because that's what I call this and that, the middle path, opening to all aspects and possibilities. It's what I coin as thrival, as rather than survival. I call it thrival. Thank you. Inclusivity.
All right. Well, you're very welcome and deserving. I am going to wrap this up. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'm going to start the second half of the show today. It is the interview with Mitchell Rabin and Dr. Michael Rice. And we will be back the rest of the week. Thank you all for being here. Blessings.
Thanks, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Hello, and welcome back to A Better World. This is your host, Mitchell J. Rabin, and we're going to have another very interesting show again today. Today, we have Dr. Michael Rice on, who is the author of this book that is growing madly and wildly in popularity, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Michael has brought the wisdom that he has from years ago in his study and involvement with physics and electronics, and has brought it to bear in the domain of human relationships, as well as our relationship to ourselves. Through a lot of pioneering research and self-reflection, he has come up with a series of programs, of classes, which he has been teaching worldwide for free for the past many years. No one is denied access to these programs because Michael made a commitment to expose anyone and everyone who would be interested in his work to it without any barrier whatsoever. So this is one of the reasons we wanted to have Dr. Michael Rice on the show today, and also to expose you all of us, to this pioneering work he's doing so we can have what we most want, a happier and better world.
Great.
So, Michael.
Glad to be here.
Pleasure to have you.
All right.
Great. What is it that first motivated you into this originally?
Going my own from the world of electronics and business and everything to make the leap that you did is quite unusual and extraordinary.
It was my own need to heal. It started out with the first year of my life, I was almost dead 3 or 4 times. And for the first 25 years, lived on an inhalator and pills, lung problems.
Oh.
And just the continuous search for how do I move out of that that mode of living, and haven't touched a pill in 25 years now.
God bless.
Once I found this new way of thinking, a different way of thinking, and naturopathic medicine, that was the end of the lung problem.
You were physically ill,
yes,
and suffering all of that, and probably were trying and using conventional medical means to solve the problem.
I'm still recovering from that part of the process.
I see,
yeah, still
right.
Detoxifying.
Yeah, can you get insurance for that kind of thing?
No, I don't think so.
And so then you obviously discovered naturopathic medicine and turned to natural means.
Correct. Well, natural means, and going further than just natural means, but looking at the interaction of how the body and the mind operate, how the emotions operate. My original work being in electronics, when I first started to study naturopathic medicine, it became clear to me that the body was an energy system. That was kind of like one of the first insights. Ah, this is just an energy system, and started to apply what I'd learned in physics to the body. And then starting to listen to Einstein, and it's interesting how long it takes for so far to catch up with good science. You listen to Einstein, and he taught us decades ago that matter doesn't exist. If matter doesn't exist, then bodies don't exist. If bodies don't exist, then what's really going on here?
Right.
So started to look from the point of view of energy and started to treat the body as an energy system And once you do that, you recognize there are basically two qualities of energy relative to the system. What builds the system up, what tears the system down.
Sure.
Integrative and disintegrative energy.
Mm-hmm.
And to start to qualify the types of energy that we choose to put into our energy system, be they physical, mental, or emotional. So tying that together with the Aramaic language, I then discovered some years after that, in listening to someone speak about the Aramaic language, that the Aramaic, which is the native language of five of the world's major religions, the Aramaic language is an energy systems language. They understood in Aramaic the latest that the physicists are now coming to understand. You know, and they said things like a little leavening leavens a whole loaf. They were talking about the principle of critical mass in physics. If you go to the opening words in the book of John, it doesn't say in the beginning was the Word and the Word became flesh. What it says is in the beginning was the mind energy or the willed action. What is our willed action? What does our mind energy have to do with the state of our physiology? Everything. And in fact, I've come to the conclusion that it is the initiation point of all disease process.
Mind.
Yes. When you put mind energy into tissue, and of course medically you're starting to prove that the mind functions through every cell in the body, when you put mind energy into tissue, wherever that energy is stored, if it is of a disintegrative nature, you begin the disintegration of the tissue.
Process, exactly.
And when tissue disintegrates, there's a cleanup crew. The bacteria and the virus bear no causal relationship to disease. They're a cleanup crew that appears spontaneously in response to decay. And they're there to clean up the decay. They're not the cause of the decay.
Absolutely true. God, it's a pleasure to hear it put so succinctly.
Oh, thank you.
really. We've had people on, cellular biologists and others, who have proven the physiological basis of consciousness and the relationship of the body to the mind and the mind to the body, and how the mind interacts with cells at neuroreceptor sites at each cell.
Right.
So we have this proven. This is no longer, you know, fancy schmancy or airy kind of new age thinking.
Right.
This is absolutely 100% grounded in science.
Yes.
And our guts have told us this all along.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what brought you to Aramaic of all languages?
I actually was invited to a lecture by some friends, back 18, 19, 20 years ago. And there was a fellow named Rocco Errico, who was a protege of a man named George Lomsa. They had thought that the Aramaic language was a dead language up until World War One, and they found
and
in the northern
speaking it.
Well, in the northern Kurdistan Mountains, they found communities of people who were living the way they were 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago.
Fantastic.
And speaking the same language. And so a fellow named Lomsa brought translations out of the Aramaic into English, and it's just so radically different from what we see that comes from the Greek thought. Most of what we see of ancient scriptures, though their source was Aramaic, we see Greek as source.
Mm-hmm.
And Greek didn't source any of that stuff, and Greek isn't capable of sourcing it because it's such a radically different thought system. And when you start to get into the Aramaic idioms and the Aramaic conceptual framework, everything that's in those scriptures is perfectly and completely logical. There is nothing mystical about it. There's not even anything religious about it. It's just, this is the way the energy system works, folks. And the idioms, for instance, one of my favorite idioms, you know, there's a statement that's often repeated as an excuse for somebody who's got their hand out saying, give me your money, of, you know, it's easier for a rich man or a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. What the heck does that mean? You go to the Aramaic, and Jerusalem was a walled city. They had gates that at night, of course, they closed, so they weren't attacked.
Mm-hmm.
But they were hospitable people, and they had off to the side a small gate. And to enter that gate, you know, if you came along at night, it was open. You could get in. You weren't left out in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
And to get in that gate, though, of course, they didn't want armies invading. You had to unload your camel. You had to get him down on his knees and force him through the gate. The gate was called the Eye of the Needle. You know, it all of a sudden makes perfect sense. There's nothing mystical anymore when you start looking from the Aramaic perspective.
Sure.
And it ties perfectly with the physics of what's going on in the world.
Now, before we get into that, was Aramaic, it wasn't a written language, was it?
Yes.
Written.
As a matter of fact, the Aramaic characters are the characters that are used today to write the Hebrew language, and it predates the Hebrew language.
It predates, that predates, I know, yeah. But you're saying that the Hebrew lettering is from
the
Aramaic.
Yes, the Strangulia, yeah.
Hmm.
And it's a language that, interestingly enough,
are they related in terms of linguistic families?
Yes, there is
Hebrew
a relationship.
Hebrew and Aramaic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as Hebrew would be a derivative of the Aramaic.
Yeah.
And the Aramaic, interestingly enough, appeared in several places on the planet simultaneously.
Such as?
With what? No historical developmental process. You know, in English we can say, well, there's a Latin root, the French root. There's none of that. It's just fully formed several places simultaneously on the planet.
But without the communities having anything to do with each other.
Correct.
They're just distinct appeared. Geographical locations.
Yes.
And spontaneous arising.
Yes. Maybe and not so spontaneous, but arising.
Well,
yes.
Right. At least arising.
Right.
Now, where are those places and
how
was this happening?
Broad. It's been found in South America, the glyphs on Easter Island. One of the translators, a fellow named Yonan, was working back when the, I believe it was the Queen of England, was being coronated back in the late 40s, early 50s. And he was doing some Aramaic translations. A friend of mine was present at the time. And they were doing this coronation service in
England.
Gaelic.
Oh,
and he starts translating. Gaelic language is Aramaic based. It's just far and wide. And it was the language of the day for, a distance of 1,000 miles or better from the Mideast to the Wall of China, that you could go and you'd find Aramaic being spoken.
In what years were those?
That goes back 2,000 to 4,000 years ago. It's the language of all of the Old Testament prophets. It's the language of Jesus. It's the language of Muhammad, the language of Baha'u'llah, the language of Zoroaster. It's thought that it might have been the language of the Buddha.
I thought Zoroaster was Persian,
mm-hmm.
was Farsi.
Yes,
and
correct.
Buddha,
and that
was
Aramaic.
Pali and Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm. But there's some, that's why Sam, I haven't been able to document it, but there's some suspicion that the Buddha actually spoke Aramaic. And right up to modern times is what, mid-1800s,
Baha'u'llah. Maybe that explains why there are so many Jews involved in Buddhism.
It could well be that the brain cells are there for it.
Wow.
So when you start looking in that language, and the whole foundation of why is this happening to me again, is that reality is not what we've been taught it is. Reality is not what's going on out there. Reality is what's happening between our ears.
Yes.
Actuality is what's happening out there. Now, you and I sit here, and externally, we look around, and we're both experiencing the same actuality, but I guarantee that your reality, the output of your mind, is different from mine, and the output of my mind is different from yours.
Now, how can we actually determine that?
Well, let's just sit and describe what's happened so far here. Well, I guarantee that if each of us sat and wrote down what's happened in the last 15 minutes together,
mm-hmm.
we would not have the same descriptors because we haven't experienced the same reality. We've experienced different realities.
Sure, we have our different interpretations of what is actually going on.
So when you start looking at reality being the output of the human mind, we're getting to see a small fragment in our minds of what's going on in the world. Some Harvard research shows that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells fire, that is 10,000 units of measurable electrical activity happen, mm-hmm. the max amount of information that goes into making up our reality in that time frame is 9 bits. It's been estimated in the same time frame that approximately 25 billion bits are available in the environment. So you and I sit here and we take the potential 25 billion bits and reduce it to 9. Ever been in a courtroom where 6 people testified about an accident and you wonder if any 2 of them were at the same accident?
Absolutely.
How does that happen?
See, this
all you have to do is organize that 9 bits of information differently, select a different 9 bits, organize it differently. You've got a different reality.
Sure. This was known many thousands of years ago by the Indians, the Tibetans, and the Chinese.
Yes.
The Abhidharma, from great classic from India, talks about the nature of perception,
mm-hmm.
and what the eye sees and what the inner eye sees and what's not seen anywhere.
Right.
How we close down Aldous Huxley and the doors of perception,
mm-hmm.
also discussed exactly the same thing, that what we admit into our consciousness, into our conscious perception, is absolutely minimal.
Right. Our illusions.
Fragmentary.
Yeah. You go into the Aramaic language and the word illusion doesn't mean something that doesn't exist, and I don't believe if you went into the Sanskrit roots, although that's not something I've done, that you'd find that the word illusion means something that doesn't exist.
Right.
The root of the word illusion in Aramaic is measured. So out of the 25 billion bits of information, what have I measured into my mind?
Mm.
What have you measured into your mind? You have an illusion, what you've measured, and I have one. Mine impacts my physiology. Yours impacts your physiology. And the basic problem where a lot of resolution lies in relationship is, if you and I interact, and let's say you bring up a painful reality in me, what's the first thing I do if I'm the natural, human being in today's culture? I deny that it's mine and I blame you.
Right.
Well, the mind is an evidential device, so now I hide all evidence of my responsibility in this situation. I blame you, and of course I invite you to change, and if you don't change, I punish you. And if punishment doesn't work, get out of my life. But what most people don't realize when that process happens is that when I throw you out of my life, I walk away with my painful reality fully intact, although I can hide it from myself. I had the distinct honor of being able to do some work with a gentleman named Marcel Vogel, who was a 23-year senior scientist from IBM.
Mm-hmm.
Marcel developed the instrumentation in the laboratory with which to take a picture of the high-energy waves that leave the mind when we think thought. So when I hold a reality, I'm literally setting up a measurable energy wave, and every energy wave that we send out carries information.
Sure.
And so if I'm in the potential of interacting with a million different people, who do you suppose is going to show up on my doorstep? The person who's in tune with that energy wave that I'm sending out.
Mm-hmm.
And so they show up and they bring up my painful reality, and I deny it and I blame them and I want them to change. And if they don't change, I punish them and throw them out of my life. What I'm essentially saying when I say you or they change is I want you to change my mind, which is ridiculous.
You're actually sending out a message to attract them.
Precisely.
And the point is that this isn't just some kind of unconscious phenomenon discussed by people like Sigmund Freud. This is an actual physical message.
This is life.
You broadcast.
Exactly. Right. And people come together in our, we do a workshop called Healing Through Relationships.
Mm-hmm.
In our Healing Through Relationships workshop, we describe most relationships as being based on matching bags of garbage. The garbage stuff, the stuff we don't want to deal with, tends to be the stuff that has emotional attachment.
Yes.
The emotion, you look at that word, energy in motion, tends to amplify those waves. And so people who have matching bags of garbage tend to resonate or be attracted to each other. And the reason for that is because there's that energy boost. You know, they talk about vibes or chemistry. There's
That's
a
right.
chemistry between us. Why? Because there's that kind of an energy exchange. And it won't be long when two people are attracted to each other before they'll know exactly how to give each other the look. Do you know anybody in your life that knows how to give you the look? You know, who can bring up every hellish thing you've ever experienced and never wanted to deal with in an instant? Right? And
sure.
So when you're playing the game of denial and blaming others, you're cut off from the information that shows you how to heal, so they become the problem. When you start to look responsibly.
Classic, I mean, the psychological language, psychoanalytic language, is projection.
Right. Well, we actually refine that a little bit from there, in that when I look at you and I say, Mitch, I see a body. Is there such a thing as a body? No. Einstein says matter doesn't exist. There's no such thing. What is there is an energy system, and because of the rate of the spin of the energy in the system, my mind can't keep up with that rate of spin and show me what you actually are. My mind generates an appearance called a body. Now, if you happen to trigger or resonate a painful reality in me, something I'm in denial about, I will literally use that information to generate my brain's image of you. So you, Mitch, show up with my painful reality attached. Go back to the Aramaic concept in Corinthians, and what does it say? Beware you who judge another, for that in which you judge another, you have been practicing. It's been going on inside of you in order to be able to see it in someone else. So when I generate, in the refinement of this work, when I generate an image of you made up of and based upon what I don't want to deal with, I literally take the content, the energy in my brain cell structure, and I project it into my brain's image of you. That's where the projection stops. It's an internal image. Then I externalize the image, and I pretend that I'm actually dealing with you rather than an
sure.
image in my brain. And most people have never had a relationship with another human being. They've only ever had relationships with images in their brain.
Just stage one.
I mean, how many people have had the experience? Anybody here ever had the experience of interacting with someone, and the next day they say, and why did you say this, and why did you do that, and why did you do that? And you sit back and you go, well, when did that happen? That never occurred. Well, are they lying to you when they say you did and you said? And you, they're not lying to you at all. You triggered those realities. Those realities came up in their minds, and they experienced them and externalize them as though you'd done it. You didn't.
In their conversation with themselves about whatever, they're saying these things. It's almost like a rehearsal, and it's getting further embedded and further imprinted.
Right.
So when they actually deal with the so-called physical person, in quotation marks, then it's like a dumping time.
Precisely. And they actually experience that person, that image in their brain, doing and saying the things
Absolutely.
That they say they didn't say.
They created
and then
that
externalize
reality.
It. That's right.
That's right.
And then they externalize it upon that person.
That's right.
And, of course, again, when I say you should change, what I'm really saying is I want you to change the image in my brain, which you can't
That's right.
do. And if we have matching bags of garbage, you're probably going to want me to change the image in your brain. And we've
right.
got a perfect formula for helpless, hopeless, and failure. Now, the alternative to that, if we
That's
actually
wonderful.
Decide to go for responsibility, is,
yeah.
gee, you know, Mitch, instead of, in the world's language, you made me angry. You know, Mitch, when you said what you just said, you brought up a lot of anger in me. And what I'd like to do is heal my anger. Would you support me? Now, that's not the kind of communication that turns people out of relationship. That's the kind of communication that tends to invite people into a relationship. Just that simple shift. We do a workshop called Communication, Did You Hear What I Think I Said? And we talk about the difference between projection language and responsibility language. And, you know, oftentimes I'll ask people in the workshop, is there anybody here that's ever been in a school, watched a movie, read a book, watched a play, been in an educational institution of any kind where two people had conflict and person one stood before person two and said, gee, you know, when you say things like that, it brings a lot of anger up for me. Would you support me healing my anger? Nobody's ever seen it in the world because the whole world teaches us to project, to make it somebody else's fault, to externalize those internal images.
That's right.
Now, you go back.
People don't even have relationships with their internal selves, by and large.
That's right.
And they know virtually nothing about the internal processes of perception or physiology of the brain, neurology, or ready to go.
Correct. Now, go back 2,000 years ago, the scene was no different. And what they said, and you go back in Aramaic and you think of it again in terms of energy, what they said in Aramaic was, do not be molded by the world or you will end up moldy. It actually didn't say it quite that way, but that's basically the message.
Yeah.
That if we
or
buy into, yeah, if
yeah.
we buy in, well, it literally becomes moldy
and
because
yeah.
if we buy
yeah,
into
yeah.
what's the game in the world today? How much hatred? How much fear? You know, turn on the 6 o'clock news and you'll find the worst mind energy
oh, yeah.
gathered from the whole of the planet for the day.
Poison.
And if you buy into that, you will literally decay your tissue structure by the storage of that information, that quality of energy in your system, so you literally end up moldy. It's the cause of death.
Well, Michael, when we say don't bother being angry at that person because you're sitting here bitterly angry about an interaction that occurred or resentful, and that person is out on their yacht having a great time fishing.
Right.
So wait a minute, what's
Doesn't
this?
Even know what happened.
Doesn't even know what happened.
That's right.
But in my own reality, I'm sitting here suffering.
Right.
And according to energetics, like in the Oriental system where there's always a relationship between an energetic system in the body and an emotion,
right.
our liver ends up getting damaged in this particular case, and on and on and on, because everything is one big interactive systemic whole.
Right, right.
Anyway,
well, the whole energy system.
I just want to say, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with this. As you're going, because of the computer function of the mind, many of the things you're saying, I'm going back and I see where a lot of this has come up in my life, on a professional level, for instance, the point you said about anger, and rather than saying you made me angry, but when you do such and such, I feel anger and da 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 da, and then processing it. Fritz Perls was talking about this, you know, 25, 30 years ago.
Right.
And that was the basis of Gestalt therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference then between what you're doing and something like Gestalt?
Well, I think that there are a lot of parallels.
There?
If there's anything that works, there have to be parallels because there's only one energy system and one set of rules by which it works.
Yes, but so there are many ways of articulating the same
thing. The ways of articulating it, and to me, one of the things that helps people break through with this work is the synthesis of several disciplines. I draw on science, I draw on psychology, I draw on the theology, the ancient Aramaic language and culture. When the mind hears it in one language, it goes, oh, that's really interesting, that's really neat. But when it hears it simultaneously in several different conceptual languages, breakthrough happens. It isn't just one part of the mind that entertains it as, oh, that's an interesting belief system, but rather it makes for a fundamental energy shift when you hear it. You know, everybody's got, or most people have got, their old church training, and then they hear the psychological language, then they hear the physics of disintegrative energy, and then, for instance, then we tie in with, let's say, another idea from the Aramaic of sin. Sin in Aramaic is not some terrible, awful thing that you've done. The word sin is an archery term. When you fire at the target, you miss the bullseye, the scorekeeper yells sin, you're off the mark. It was meant to be positive feedback, as in take another shot.
I said that's
not you terrible, horrible thing.
But that's from the Greek.
But the original Aramaic concept, the word
kakah,
is sin, off
Beautiful.
The mark.
Right.
So now when you think of that in terms of this body-mind unit, if I sin, if I bring an energy in that's off the mark, then I self-destruct. The wages of sin is death is a statement of physiology, not religion. The result of bringing disintegrative energy into yourself, you get the original, they get the carbon copy, and who gets to pay the price? You know, if I hate...
Sure.
We had a gal in one of
this
our intensives...
This is disintegrative for me.
Correct. We had a gal in one of our intensives this past summer. We have a teaching center in the Ozarks called Heartland. And she came up with just a beautiful definition for bitterness, but it really applies to all of the emotions, and that is that bitterness is drinking a cup of poison and waiting for somebody else to die. You know? And when we hate, when we have fear, anger, vengeance, criticism, condemnation, gossip, slander, they're all energies that we put into our system. We get the original. It's registered in every cell in the system, incidentally, including the germ cell. So if someone conceives a child, that child receives every reality, every thought, every feeling, every reality that both parents have engaged in. It becomes part of their actual physiological structure.
And parents, so, lineage.
Yes, precisely. They say genetic disease. There's no such thing as a genetic disease, but there is an energy system that registers everything that goes into it, and so it reflects as a disease process.
Sure.
And we are, or have the ability,
parentage.
Right. And we have the ability, and are in fact continuously, I would offer, changing our genetic structure by what we put into it and what we remove. In the Aramaic language,
right,
and kind of one of the core tools that we teach is a tool called reality management. That's what we focus on in this book. That particular is one of the main tools that we
show
work on.
This book.
Well, let's show that book. Sure.
Yeah.
But the reality management tool is from the Aramaic, forgiveness. In Aramaic, the word forgive doesn't mean I'll let you off the hook, Mitch, for the terrible thing you've done to me. The word forgive means a tool for changing a reality in my mind. So now when you and I interact, if I can be responsible and say, gee, this is my rage, I'd like to heal my rage, rather than an enemy to blame it on, I have a potential support team to assist me in healing it. And so now, and then another tool we teach in Why Is This Happening to Me Again is called My Commitment, which comes from our Healing Through Relationships workshop. And there we kind of lay out a blueprint or a roadmap for, okay, when trauma comes up in a relationship, here's how you can shift the energy. Here's how you can create a cooperative process for moving through it rather than keep loading on the trash until there's no relationship left.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Let's give people a number where they can find out more information about getting your book and the kind of work you're doing, because you're teaching worldwide and you teach in the Ozarks. So
yeah, we travel around the country
continuously.
All of the work that we do when we travel is done free. And our commitment is to make the tools we teach available to every mind on the planet. And if people want more information about the book or our teaching center, the work we do, our number is 800-583-4827. We also have a website if somebody wants to look up there and find out what our schedule is,
good,
if they want to visit a workshop.
Good.
And our website is www.kcmo, as in Kansas City, Missouri, kcmo.com/why again. www.kcmo.com/why again. So they can always access our schedule there or through the 800 number.
Let's give them the 800 number again one more time.
Sure. 583-9827 is where we can be found.
Excellent.
And we do summer programs in the Ozarks. People will come and study with us anywhere from 9 days to 4 months. at a time.
Oh.
And then when we travel, we do a series of 2.5-hour workshops. And each workshop is geared to giving a specific tool. Like if people come to the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, they'll walk out after 2.5 hours with a tool. Here's what you can do with
it. Very practical.
Yeah, it's, well, with the background in electronics, you know, when you're working with electronic equipment, philosophy doesn't mean a darn thing.
Sure.
When you come out the other end and plug in, it's got to work. And so my focus has always been, well, how do we get this down to something that works?
Exactly.
Something that people can actually use. So in a 2.5-hour time frame or out of the book, people can actually step in and come out of it with a step-by-step set of tools.
Well, it's wonderful work, and if you'd stay tuned, we'll pick up where we left off.
Great. Let's do it.
Pleasure having
you
on the show, Michael.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Good. So we've been talking with Dr. Michael Rice, the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And his work really offers an avenue for getting out of Why This Is Happening to Me Again. Don't you all know what that feels like? Again? So, stay tuned for the next show. We'll be picking up with Michael and carrying on and looking at some specifics of people he's worked with over the years. This is Mitchell J. Rabin for A Better World. We're very glad you've joined us again. Call me at 212-420-0800. Share your thoughts and feelings with me. You know I love hearing from you. And I look forward to seeing you all next week. Hello, and welcome back to A Better World. This is your host, Mitchell J. Rabin, and we're very glad that you're joining us again today. Today we're going to be continuing on with Dr. Michael Rice, the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And What You Can Do About It. So we're going to be talking about the way we perceive, the nature of perception, the nature of emotions from a physiological point of view. Actually, how keeping negative emotions circulating in your mind and body, as if there were a difference, are impacting your health. And, of course, what you can do about it, how you can turn around that trend. So Michael has been traveling the world and offering his workshops and classes for free for many, many years. He's the author of this book with over 70,000 in print now and has a program that's offered in a center in the Ozarks where anyone is free to go and meet with him and experience this really groundbreaking work that he's doing out there. We're very impressed with him here and very pleased to have him on the show again. So I want to welcome you again, Michael.
Thank you. Nice
Absolutely.
To be here.
Good, good. Why don't we give a number where people can, if they want to get more information about the book, call up and also learn
sure.
about your workshops and programs.
Sure, they can call us at 800-583-9827 and get information on our travel workshops, 583-9827, on the schedule at Heartland and what happens there. We basically do a summer program there each year, and our workshops there run anywhere from 9 days to 4 months. And then when we travel, and we usually travel 6 to 10 months of the year, all of our travel work is done free, so it's available to anyone and everyone.
That's fantastic. That's just fantastic. See, it can be done, folks. It can. You can really follow your heart and listen and act on that basis and have an incredibly rich life. And here's proof right here.
Let's go for it.
Yeah? Okay. Good. So we were talking about forgiveness
mm-hmm.
at the end of the last show.
Right.
And when we spoke recently, you had told me a story which I wish you would share with the audience,
of meeting with a group of physicists?
Well, basically, the synthesis of the different ideas leads to being able to convey the same message in several different conceptual languages.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have, and I think it was Winston Churchill that said that we have the privilege of being separated by a common language, that we develop a language to describe an observed phenomenon, and we think because somebody describes it, that phenomenon, in a different conceptual language, that they're talking about something different, as though there could be a conflict, for instance, between science and theology. And the truth is, there's only
Absolutely.
One thing operating in the world, and that's energy. And there are many
like
conceptual
itself.
Frameworks to speak of it in. And so what I was saying in that conversation is that I have done it many times, sat with physicists and explained the process of forgiveness from an energy perspective and from a physics level. You know, research, Brain Bio Institute, National Institute of Health, says that every thought we think forms a molecule in the body. Forms a molecule in the body. I mean, they're talking, this is hard science. This is the National Institute of Health telling us this. And the quality of the molecule, of course, determines the quality of the whole physiological system. This is Candace Pert. Oh, okay. Yes. And so
she's the only one there who would say that.
Well, maybe the only one that would admit it.
Yeah, right.
You know, in out in the front lines,
right.
But behind the
door. Those aren't in the holistic medicine department.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. So you can speak in the language of physics about this energy system called the body, and that if you put enough hate into it, you're going to start to deteriorate the quality of the body, the quality of the emotions that system produces, the quality of realities that it generates internally, and the quality of relationship and world that it creates.
And then
forgiving, removing those realities is what allows the system to go back and rebuild itself. It's the key to all forms of healing.
Mm-hmm.
Without forgiveness, true healing doesn't ever happen. You can shift symptoms around in the system. You can, you know, pop a pill and knock a disintegrative energy out of this particular tissue structure, but it shows up somewhere else. You'll notice somebody who started on one drug for the ABC disease 20 years ago is now taking 12 drugs for 12 different diseases.
And also antidote the drugs they were taking for ABC.
Precisely.
Disease.
Yes.
Disease.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly. Before you had mentioned, so what is the definition in Aramaic of forgiveness then?
Well, let's lay a little bit of foundation in case people didn't hear the first show. Reality in the foundation of this work is the output of the human mind. Actuality is what's going on in the world.
Sure.
As I said in the last show, you and I right now experiencing the same actuality are experiencing different realities. If around this particular actuality, I experience a painful reality. In the Aramaic, they would describe the process of forgiveness as the tool with which I get rid of my painful reality. It isn't letting you off the hook for having done it to me. The whole concept of forgiveness, as it comes from the Aramaic, was totally deteriorated when it was passed into the Greek culture and the Greek language. You'll remember
and
that the whole
tradition.
Well, not necessarily. Now, if you look at the Eastern Christian traditions, totally different things.
Eastern Orthodox?
Yes, it's a whole different process because they come out of the Aramaic, out of the Eastern thought.
And they remain connected to it.
Yes, and they still use Aramaic scriptures today. But you go into the Greek, and remember, the Greek philosophies externalized the powers. The gods were all out there.
Sure.
So, you know, there was a god for this and a god for that. Some of the most horrific creatures you can imagine. I mean, they raped their mothers. They killed their fathers. They killed their children. I mean, incredible. But the powers were primarily external.
Uh-huh.
Now, when you think about that, if that's the conceptual framework that one comes from, that the powers are external, is it any wonder that we're talking about forgiveness in terms of forgiving them? And basically what's happened is, for the Aramaic concept of forgiveness, the Greek concept of pardoning has been substituted. So now I'll pardon this external power, this person
that's
who's...
That's exactly right, yeah.
And in so doing, I cut myself off from the ability to see the part of me that's involved. Now you go back into the Aramaic thought, and the power is
more external.
In fact, it doesn't
include that at all.
No.
There's no reference to self.
None whatsoever.
Yeah.
But in the Aramaic... You'll notice that the powers were internal. You know, the speaking was about the Father within that did the work. That's where the power was.
Yes.
And so we're now talking in terms of forgiveness of going within and finding the root of the energy that creates this disintegrative, painful reality in me and changing it and getting rid of it. And you just can't talk about it in Greek. You know, I like to use an analogy. It'll be in my next book. A little story that I created. Let's imagine that we go to the jungles of South America and we're on the edge of the forest or deep in the forest and we see a man who has just walked 20 miles from his native home, and he comes to the edge of the forest where he sees this huge yellow animal with round legs rolling back and forth and just knocking down trees left, right, and center. And then another huge yellow machine comes in, or animal, and it puts this black surface, smooth surface, over this area that it's torn the forest out of. And this fellow, you know, I mean, over a period of weeks, he watches in amazement as this happens. And then he hears this loud roaring noise. And he watches this huge, shiny bird fly out of the sky, land, and it does the most amazing thing. First of all, its mouth is not on the front like every other bird he's ever seen. Its mouth is on the side. It opens its mouth and it spits out live people. And then it eats more people, and when it eats those people, it up and flies away again. Now, you and I know that we're talking about an airplane, but this fellow from deep, deep in the jungles, can he go back and say one meaningful word to his compatriots 20 miles away about what he's observed? There is nothing in the language or the culture to do it. The only way he could possibly start to make sense of that would be, number one, to learn the paradigm that includes airplanes and what they're about, to learn a language to describe it, and then to his listeners, he has to bring them into the same paradigm before he can say anything meaningful. Now, in the Aramaic, that was talked about as having the eyes to see and the ears to hear. You remember they talked about the inner teachings. Well, they weren't available unless you had the information in brain cells already. So having information in brain cells is what was called the eyes to see and the ears to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's imagine that we've got someone who speaks about a power within whose nature is that of love, whose good pleasure it is to bring you everything that you want, and then you try to transfer that thought system into a thought system that has these horrific external powers. Is there a chance of telling the truth about what was said in the Aramaic? It's lost. It's just simply lost. And when you go back there, you find that it describes this energy system called life. It describes the process of forgiveness. And it describes how we anesthetize ourselves against feeling, that our unwillingness to feel. You know, when you look at the idea of pain, we've been taught in this culture pain is this terrible, awful thing that you've got to get rid of, and you just run out and pop a pill and then everything will be fine. But let's imagine, you know, cancel the image, but let's imagine that the fire alarm goes off and warns us that there's a fire happening in the building. And Mitch says, gee, well, you know, we are taping, Michael. Tell you what, why don't you just hold on for a second? I got a pair of wire cutters here. I'll go cut the wires to the bell. Well, hey, everything's quiet, right? Pain's gone. Fire alarm's gone. The noise is gone. But the fire still rages somewhere. When somebody pops a pill, which is nothing but a warning signal, it's this energy system
saying... The pain is the warning signal.
The pain is the warning signal. It says, hey, there's something in this system you've got to deal with. And to run out and find a way to shut off the signal does absolutely nothing to deal with the raging fire, to deal with whatever's going on in tissue that doesn't belong there.
Michael, in a paragraph, you just described the nature of allopathic medicine.
Yes. Yes, and not that there isn't a place for that, because people do get into the crisis places where, gee, that's necessary, but I think the thing to understand is that there's no healing in that system.
Right.
What there is symptom suppression, long-term alleviation of symptoms, but when you alleviate a symptom by driving it deeper into tissue, you tend to create more degenerative conditions. And so you'll notice that the more and more they become, they perfect this idea of a pill is going to take care of this, the more long-term degenerative disease we have.
Absolutely.
Because the suppressive aspect drives the energy deeper into tissue, which creates deeper and deeper levels of degeneration. And even before people get to the pills, get to the things with which they suppress those symptoms, we suppress in many different ways just in our normal day-to-day lives. For instance, if you watch somebody in pain and trauma in a situation that they're upset about, one of the number one things they'll do is stop breathing. The breath, you know, every energy system has a switch. When you look at this body-mind unit as an energy system, the breath is the switch for the mind energy system. And when you recognize that the breath is the switch for the mind energy system, then you recognize when you shut the breath off, you've suppressed, you've locked an energy somewhere in tissue that doesn't belong in tissue. When you start to breathe, you can then access that which you've been hiding from yourself. If breath doesn't work to suppress, then oftentimes the next mode of suppression, or actually it goes a little further into anesthetizing, is hostility. Hostility is a drug, and it's a particularly difficult drug to break away from because the internal, the supplier is internal, and it's free.
Could you describe what are the effects? I mean, certainly we know what the effects are emotionally for oneself as well as interactively. But what happens physiologically when a person remains hostile?
Well, first of all, you'll notice, and if you get somebody in a hostile condition and get them to quiet down, underneath the hostility there's always pain. And so the pain is the first step, and when one doesn't have a way of dealing with the pain, and this is a habit that starts, you know, 2 years, you know, they call it the terrible twos, 2 years of age and less. Yeah, that when the pain isn't dealt with and it's suppressed, the mechanism of suppression oftentimes is that hostility, and it creates a chemistry in the body that shuts down feelings. And so always, and the more hostile someone is, the more pain there is. Now you look at this culture where we have this penal system, and what happens? Well, let's just take this hostile person and let's go and inflict more pain on them. That'll teach them. Like, why is recidivism in the 99th percentile? Because you just reinforce the whole cause process. We don't need a penal system. We don't need... Does that mean that we shouldn't take the murderer out of society? No, it doesn't mean that at all. But to inflict more pain on an energetic level just guarantees more of it will happen in that particular body and in the bodies left in the culture. What do you mean, Michael? What I mean is that pain is an energy dynamic. If you take, let's say... Let's look at the child abuser. What do most people want to do with the child abuser? Abuse them, right?
Pain.
They want to abuse them.
Yep.
Now, start to think about that as an energy dynamic.
Sure.
If you have one mind engaged in abuse of a child, there's a certain energy dynamic of that. In our last show, I talked about the high-energy waves that a 23-year senior scientist, Marcel Vogel, was able to measure coming from the mind. So if we have this person who's the abuser, and we publicize the case so highly that everybody in the culture knows about it, we just engaged how many million minds in the energy of abuse and pain. We just increased child abuse, guaranteed.
Yep.
Because the mind that otherwise...
Those molecules are being manufactured.
That's right. And the individual who perhaps has a propensity toward abuse but would never do it, all of a sudden the energy dynamic of that resonance drives them into what previously would not have been a behavior-driving reality all of a sudden becomes one. Now let's put this guy behind bars and make sure he gets the worst punishment possible. Locking him in that little cage, he radiates an energy that will touch every potentially hostile mind or child-abusing mind on the planet. And by the inflicting of pain, we create more child abuse. Now, we have someone who's an abuser, yeah, maybe they need to, you know, we need to take up a collection and remove them from the culture. But what we need to do is create a space where that pain can be dealt with. Well, teach one how to use tools with which to eliminate the pain that the hostility is a cover for.
Sure. Otherwise, you know, it's not only manufacturing more hostility because they are stewing in hostility inside, but the notion of them suffering at all is an expression of our collective hostility.
That's correct. That's exactly it.
So and before you know it, hostility becomes the generic and general mode of the day.
Right. Well, we have a whole chapter in the book on that idea, or several pages that address the idea of hostility, and we compare it to the alcoholic. And the book is done in a conversation format with a character named Richard, and one of the most common comments we get from folks who read it is, "Oh my God, I'm Richard." Or, "Oh my God, I live with Richard." But one of the things he talks about is, well, you know, but the alcoholic, sure, the wife's got a cover for him, because if she doesn't call the boss and cover for him, he's going to lose his job. It's like, well, but let's really take a look at what the cost of that is. What does it cost her over a period of a lifetime and her children and her family structure to enable the alcoholic? And we compare that in the book with the way the culture enables the hostility addict. I mean, how many jobs are there in the culture?
Absolutely
what is,
right.
What, half of the budget of the country goes to military? If that isn't enabling people to play the hostility game?
There's no question. There's no question.
You know, you look at so much of the bureaucracy that's in our culture.
We talk about the subject of self-empowerment a lot, and
mm-hmm.
standing up for what one believes in one's heart and feels in one's heart. And would you address that subject of, I'd like you to talk about two things. I agree with what you're saying, by the way, and I really appreciate your articulating these points. Two areas I'd like you to talk to, if you would. One is the subject of belief system and the physiology of belief system, and the other is self-empowerment and what happens when people start to see the difference between actuality and their own perception of reality and start to shift that so they can become self-empowered.
Right. Well,
how do you deal with that?
When you look at the idea that the mind selects a tiny fragment of information out of the actuality with which to produce its reality, you're looking at an evidential mind.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if I live in the world of I'm right, you're wrong, it's settled, why argue? When my mind goes to generate a reality about you...
Where most people live.
Right.
But anyway.
But when my mind goes to generate a reality about you, I can only access, because of the evidential nature of the mind, my mind will only be allowed to access data that proves you're wrong. And my mind will generate, it doesn't matter how right you are, my mind will generate a reality that proves that you're wrong because all other information will be suppressed.
It's like doing a global search with one word in a computer program.
Precisely. Yes. And you only get what's hooked to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I'm in the I'm right, now my mind generates a reality about me. It doesn't matter how far off base I am, my mind is only allowed to access the information that proves that I'm right. And so I generate a reality that shows that I'm right.
Right.
And there's no discussion now because I will not allow that information into my mind. We call that blockage of truth. Most people live
you mean the contrary
in
information.
Blockage of truth.
The contrary information.
Yes. I can't see the truth of what's going on. I can't see that I'm living in an error and I won't. My mind literally can't access the truth. So when you start to see that, then you see that the evidential nature of the mind is that it makes everything that comes up in the mind, the only information and evidence that can be accessed, is information of our own BS. Now, of course, many people listen to that word and go, what? Belief system.
Not me. Oh.
Belief system.
Oh, no.
Somebody got a different reality for those initials than belief system in our audience here? Notice that's the reality in your mind, not the one in mine. That's the belief system. I'm sure.
Okay.
And so we only get to see the evidence that our belief system allows to be shown to us until we correct the mind. And the way to correct the disease called blockage of truth is love of truth, that we've got to love the truth more than we do our own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look in the culture,
absolutely.
The traditional is you love your own opinion and to hell with the truth. You know,
yeah.
It's like, who cares?
Right.
What's interesting is, well, I have a reality and that's what's really important. And when we do that, we just get so far off base in life that life becomes almost unrecognizable compared to the way human beings are designed to live.
Absolutely.
One of the questions I'll often ask people in my workshops is, how many can go back, and usually it's when we're about this high, and can remember a time when you looked around at a hostile, conflict-driven world, and you said to yourself, this isn't the way it's supposed to work. Anybody out there do that? Can you remember when you knew the world was supposed to work differently? And in the workshop, while, you know, of course, most people will raise their hands, and I ask, what is it that you remember knowing about the world? And literally 100% of the time, people's recollection is some variation on the theme of love, that they knew that's how life was supposed to work. Why? Because that's the stuff we're made of, and it is the only energy that fuels the human mind properly. When we plug the mind into hostility or fear, anybody here ever find that you're the most creative, the most intelligent, and have the most choices when you're in a hostile state? Good luck. Anybody find that you're most creative, have your most choices when you're in a fearful state? No. When are you most creative? When do you have the most flexibility and the most options and the most powerful choice? And when are you most self-empowered? When you're in a state of love. Because that's the only energy that fuels the human mind properly. When you unplug it, you destroy the mind instantly becomes dysfunctional. I like to tell a little story about the rose and the butterfly. Let's imagine we have a rose and a butterfly, and the rose and the butterfly meet and they fall in love. Let's give them each an ego. They meet and they fall in love, and they have a wonderful time together. It's just grand. But one day the butterfly up and flies away. The rose, knowing that the love of the butterfly was the most important thing in its life, uproots itself to give chase. What's going to happen to the rose?
It's going to die,
right? Why is it going to die? It's going to die because it made something more important than being connected to its source. Whenever you or I, as human beings, make anything more important than being connected to love, our source, we initiate our own death. And go back to Corinthians. With man, death began. They understood the energy dynamics of life and death. We made the process of death up. And forgiveness is the way that you undo and remove those realities that destroy human physiology. You'll notice in the Aramaic that they didn't refer to the body as a body. They called it a temple. They knew it was an energy system. They knew it wasn't a physical thing. And they knew the qualities of energy that didn't belong in it. And they knew how to forgive, how to remove the realities, the qualities of energy that didn't belong in it. And that's really the whole core of the work that we do. In our workshop entitled Healing Through Relationships, we provide a kind of a roadmap to creating a relationship in a different way than the world has taught us. And in fact, it's on the back of our book.
Yeah.
It's called My Commitment. I don't know whether you can see that or not.
Do you want to read it?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was thinking about doing exactly that. See if you could catch a glimpse of it. Probably doesn't come through too. Well, I guess it's there. Sure. So My Commitment, the tool we teach in Healing Through Relationships, says this: I promise to trust you enough to tell you the truth and treat you lovingly, gently, and with respect in my thoughts, my words, and my actions, whether I'm in your presence or not. In every interaction, I'll look for and acknowledge the highest and best in you as I surrender to love, our true nature. Being connected to my source and nurturing my relationship with you will always be more important than any issue. If anything less than love comes up, I'll hold this in my heart and listen as we each learn to speak, experience, and be responsible for our own realities. I'll be there for and with you, keep communication open, and keep love conscious, active, and present as we heal and celebrate life. So that's one of the tools we teach in the book and in our workshop, Healing Through Relationships.
Mm, that's great. Now, if you would, just tell us a story or two, would you, of some of the people who have come to your classes, your workshops, and what has happened? Do you have a favorite one or two that you could share?
Well, probably one of the most recent. We had a fellow, we did a thing out in Los Angeles last year, and there was a fellow there who came by to pick up, actually he came by to pick up Jim Redfield's book. If you've read Celestine Prophecy, you might remember in the front of Celestine Prophecy, Jim acknowledges, why is this happening to me again and myself? And he came by, we had Jim's book on our table, and it was packaged with Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And so he picked our book up too, and sent us a copy of a letter that he had sent to his psychiatrist along with a copy of the book. And in the letter, he talked about how he'd been, you know, seeing this psychiatrist for 35 years, 2 to 4 times a week, and that if he had had the tools in this book, and that's all he had was just the book, if he'd had the tools in the book 35 years ago, he wouldn't have had to go through that 35 years of trauma. And he speaks in the letter about his anguish and his hatred and such that that just totally destroyed himself and didn't realize that it all was a reality in his own mind that he could do away with forgiveness. And so it's pretty transforming to watch that sort of thing happen.
Sure.
The commitment will oftentimes have people who will contact us. We get a lot of invitations to weddings because people will use the relationship commitment as their wedding vows. And so we get to hear a lot of stories of people in trauma and turmoil who come across that information and healing through relationships and start to use the commitment as a set of tools, as a roadmap for achieving a different form of relationship. And we'll see people who, they're either in process of divorce or on the verge of divorce, who actually start to use those tools. And we'll hear from them, God, we're back on our second honeymoon. You know, it's just like we forgot why
how
we got together.
Gratifying.
The painful realities that are triggered in relationship. And there's a reason for that, because when we're drawn to someone in relationship, we're drawn to the person who knows how to show us what we need to deal with. The purpose of relationship is that of a sacrament. And a sacrament isn't something religious. A sacrament is that which is given to us designed to take us back to our true nature, which is love. Which means that everything in us that's less than love has to come to the surface. But if we're playing that game of denial, projection, and externalization, when it comes to the surface, we don't see that this is true about us. We see that it's true about them. And a key thought to tap into there is that every reality output from the mind always tells more about the content of the mind than it does about the world we think we're observing. It always tells us more about us.
Absolutely.
And it's our opportunity to start to clean up the internal process that, if we don't clean it up, ends up being our physiological disease. It ends up being
our
body chemistry.
And our external environment.
Yes.
Well, and
yes.
Our external environment. Yes. Which reminds me, in closing, I just want to share this wonderful phrase that you put in mind here, which is love attracts everything unlike itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we are in relationship, we find ourselves facing all those parts that are, in a sense, below love, not quite up to love, so that we can bring the whole system
right
up to love.
Precisely, yeah. If we decide, okay, well, I want to embody this higher ideal, everything unlike the ideal has to float to the surface to
absolutely
be healed, has to be cleaned out.
Absolutely.
There's a poem that we
have
in here.
Say it real quickly.
Really fast.
Really
it's called
fast.
Each Moment. Each moment of love, each moment of giving, each moment of joy is a moment of living. Each moment of anger, each moment of lying, each moment of resentment is a moment of dying. All our moments add together, like the digits in a sum, and the answer tells us plainly whether our life or our death shall come. Kind of sums the whole thing up in a nutshell.
It really does. Thank you so much.
Delighted.
It's been a pleasure. Very good.
Great.
Thanks again.
Blessings.
Absolutely.
All right.
It's Mitchell Raven for A Better World.